question or favorite recipe, please email us at recipeforpeacenow@gmail.com or visit our website, www.recipeforpeacenow.com. Also, if you would like to hear prior shows, they are archived on that website, recipeforpeacenow.com. Thanks. Now let's get started. This time we're going to be talking about feeling guilty. And you know, a lot of us feel guilty about some personal things and things we didn't do and like that. But we're going to be talking about it within our context, within the context of an alternative dispute resolution, a mediation, getting people together to reach a successful outcome to make something happen, right? Yeah, a negotiation, even a workshop and a seminar, which we do lots of. And sometimes all of the issues that we talk about pop up in those too. Mm-hmm. So let's talk about feeling guilty within our context. So what types of feeling guilty problems do we often see, and what should we do to fix them? Because we're a practical group, right? We'd like to know. Mm-hmm. You know what? This is kind of interesting. There's lots of you. Thank you all for being here. Thank you for all of you for all of your participation. We have You know how we do this kind of without being scripted. It has to do with what the questions are and what people like to talk about. And we have a lot of people in a category of guilt that I wouldn't have actually picked as number one. But that's what you guys are kind of picking as number one. I'm going to call it privileged guilt. Mm-hmm. That the person who's feeling guilty has a great deal more privileged lifestyle, more access maybe, more education, more than the other people in the room. And it makes them feel guilty. Mm-hmm. See, I recognize that as a type of guilt that people feel, but it wouldn't have been my number one choice. Isn't that interesting? Yeah, a lot of you see that. Fabulous. It probably means we have a lot of privileged people in our groups, which there's nothing, absolutely nothing wrong with that. Now, pardon me, didn't mean to cough in your ear. Goes to show it's a live show. Mm-hmm. Our second one, I think, is going to be, you know, we've got lots and lots of ideas. Thank you all for being here. That somebody or some group perhaps actually did something wrong. Mm-hmm. And they don't want anybody to find out. They're feeling kind of guilty about it. They actually did something kind of not so good. I see it a lot with not necessarily criminal activity, as in if you find out somebody's going to jail or paying a fine. I see it mainly in kind of taking shortcuts to a solution, kind of maybe not looking at everything really too closely that didn't lead to a straight line to the shortcut. Yeah? Yeah. So did something wrong in the past, did something kind of not real what you would have liked to talk about, and you don't want anybody to find out. Uh-huh. I like this third one a lot because this is a truth that we don't often say. Pardon me. You know, I'm going to take a sip of water. Hang on 1 second so I can stop coughing in your ear. Hang on. Here we go. Bend over and get this water. Hold on. It's kind of cool. Hello, all of you going, have you got a cold? No, thank you for asking, though. It's very nice of you. You know, we talk about preconceived notions and biases and prejudice and like that a lot. And we talk about what to do about them and how people have them and how they get them and how to counter them and like that. But this is interesting as under the feeling of guilt. I'm going to call it that when people know that they're biased and they have a preconceived notion and like that, and they kind of like it. Right? Yeah. They kind of like their preconceived notion there. And they're biased, and they feel a little guilty about it because they know that's obnoxious and it's not what you're supposed to do, but they're feeling kind of attached. Mm-hmm. How about guilty feelings over over-exaggerated abilities or expertise or background? Sometimes there's even some puffery in something like a resume or a biography, right? Yeah. Kind of, maybe not an outright lie, but for sure a pretty big exaggeration. Mm-hmm. And maybe somebody has lied and said, no problem, I've done that before, lots. And there is a problem and they haven't done it before and they don't want anybody to find out if they can help it. Mm-hmm. And I think our fifth one, because it's been my experience that we don't actually get the privilege of talking to about more than five because we've only got an hour, and you guys do like the recipe at the end, which I confess I don't always get to. When you have guilty feelings because you've got like an ulterior motive, a secret reason for wanting something, right? A secret motive, a secret desire, maybe people call it a secret desire, right? Yeah. And you know it's not what you're supposed to do, not the reason you're supposed to be there, but there we have it, yes. So let's talk about these. Let's talk about how to recognize them, and let's talk about what to do about them, for heaven's sakes. Mm-hmm. Let's do privileged guilt first. Eric and others are saying it's when you feel guilty that you have a better position than the others, so you overcompensate in negotiation. I've seen that. God, I love those people to be on the other side. Oh, did I say that? Because they concede lots of stuff, right? Yeah, and you get to look like a genius. But if they're on your side and you need to have a serious negotiation, well, you need somebody in a business-like frame of mind because we're all equals. Mm-hmm. Especially if the guilty part, the feeling guilty, privileged guilty, was not actually caused by anybody in the room or anybody in some way affiliated with anybody in the room. See, that's a different matter because then there can be restitution of some sort. And that's outside of the negotiation process, really, or maybe a part of it. Mm-hmm. I've done that. Sometimes you have a client or the person who is hired, you want a client, who has the wrongdoing that they're kind of feeling guilty about, right, which is our second topic, they actually did something wrong, is they kind of did something wrong to the participants in some way now. Mm-hmm. They ripped them off somehow, for example. They gave them kind of a not enough hearing, not enough consideration. And something happened that was really pretty unfair, right? Yeah, I've seen that. Businesses sometimes, I deal a lot with multinational corporations, and the bottom line is kind of king. It's very, very important. And the morality line, where you say, is this the right thing to do, or is this really secretly doing a wrong act? For example, you know that someone, I just saw this actually, you know that someone, a business, it was really not individual, but a business is like an individual, didn't understand the ramifications of what they were doing because you'd kind of led them believe it was for their benefit. And you didn't mention the part that was really kind of not for their benefit, right? Mm-hmm. See, I don't engage in those, but sometimes I see the aftermath. And the results were negative and kind of extreme, kind of big time. They were really life-changing, business-changing, really... really, gee, that really not good thing, type changing, if you know what I mean. Yeah? And it is, during negotiations, I talked to the client about this, and I couched it in a way that they would understand, like public relations, right? Mm-hmm. And to make restitution, to help set right what had been done wrong, because my clients were the privileged ones, the ones that had the privileged guilt, and they did feel kind of bad about it. on a certain, well, human level, I suppose it would be, but even on a certain public relations media type level, they thought it would be a good thing to make restitution. You have to put it to people the way they understand it, right? And these clients understood the multinational corporation, and what they understood was money. And they understand that they've got lots of money, and a few million dollars is not going to be much of a difference to them. It's pocket change. And they could gain a lot of media good, a lot of goodwill towards them and their product if they helped this company that was in negotiation with us. But that's, we made it part of the negotiation that there be restitution because that's favorable to us, right? But the negotiation didn't hinge on it. But there wouldn't have been the restitution at all. And it was, all right, it was substantial to the company that was being compensated, that was being given the money. It made a big difference to them. And quite frankly, because of the size of my client, no difference hardly at all. It was just a line item on the accounting. And they took it off as public relations, like advertising, right? Yeah. And so it wasn't, it was a lot of money, but not to a multinational, but yes, to a private concern. So, privileged guilt. I got them to make some restitution in addition to a favorable negotiation, but never confuse them. It's separate. Mm-hmm. Restitution is, well, first of all, it shouldn't hang on the outcome of the negotiation, but it makes for a, well, it makes for a more convivial negotiation atmosphere, right? We've already given you something that we didn't have to, legally speaking, but you've been damaged. You couldn't sue us, but we're going to help you, right? Yeah, and bring out the brass bands in the media. But that's, hey, everybody wins. Everybody gets a good out of it. Yeah, well, what good is being an anonymous donor, right? Yeah. So they did something wrong that you didn't want anybody to find out. Not legally wrong. But it gave them privileged guilt. See the relationship? Yeah. So that I could solve it. I could make it better. I could make everybody whole. Yeah. It was a mighty fine day, if you know what I mean, because we had success all around and everybody benefited. And that's really what you want. Mhm. Yeah. Mm-hmm. So the compensation, but it's different from the negotiation, though. You know, Hussein is making a real good point about what I just said, and this is really true. He says what they got was the appearance of political correctness. The appearance of political correctness. Now, that's kind of politically correct is kind of an Americanism, I think, and of course this is a global show. And there's nothing really to do with politics, as in we're about to elect the President of the United States and other fairly high up officials in the United States. It has to do more with saying what you're supposed to say so that you don't show bias. The appearance of political correctness. I like it. Yeah. You know, Hussein's got a good point that it is kind of a media ploy in its way. It's like marketing. I say what it is that the public expects me to say. It is like being a politician in that respect. It's probably why it's called that. Political correctness. Because, let's face it, I don't care what country you're in or who is, what kind of a government you've got. Politicians, the people in charge, say whatever it is they need to say to stay in charge, right? Right. Mm-hmm. The appearance of political correctness. I like it, Hussein. Mm-hmm. Yeah, a good point, too. Bobby and others are saying that in my example, and also in most privileged guilt examples, what they've done is they've kind of bought themselves a public image as one of the people. But you know, that is a negotiating tool. That is something to understand, that especially the privileged people, organizations, usually organizations that are run by a lot of privilege, right? They get paid huge fees, huge salaries and all kinds of perks and stuff, which they want to keep. But they all want to look, especially in the United States, I bet everywhere else too. Yeah, I'm getting a lot of agreement that they want to look like one of the people. I'm one of you. I understand you. I love you. I want you to be, you know, fabulous. One of the people. It's kind of a public image. And that is truly something that you can use as a tool for privileged guilt to get them to, well, give you some sort of a benefit. Might even not be money. Sometimes you need something for a client, or as a negotiation point, that has not so much to do with actual money. Might have to do with benefits, which is kind of actual money, but not salary. I do some union work, for example, and they want concessions. And some of it is not even money in the pocket of the participants, of the employees, for example, in a union, but some sort of a safety measure, maybe. Some sort of reduced hours. Yeah. Something that would benefit the lives of the workers. Remember, we are one of the people. Yes. Uh-huh. Yes. And you can use that if you understand that desire, then you can use that in your negotiations. Yes, 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 yes. A lot of people are calling it a media ploy. Charles and others. That's a media ploy to capture favorable image and publicity. Media ploy to capture favorable image and publicity. Maybe you say the word ploy to me, and people are using the word fraud and deception and like that. Well, I would go with that. Fraud, deception, ploy type thing, if they don't pay up, if they don't do whatever it is that they've told the media they're going to do. They make a big splash, and then nothing comes of it, right? Yeah, we've seen that too in our practices, haven't we? Some sort of a big splash, mainly something that's not a definite thing, like an amount of money, an amount of hours, a safety provision in some way, something that's more nebulous and therefore harder to actually track whether or not it was done, right? Yeah, whether or not it was done. And, yeah, exactly. People are talking about equality. That's a little harder to track. What does that mean? How do we judge it? When do we have sufficient safety measures and not just the very bare-bone basics? That's tracking injury, but where do we draw the line between this is a good safety measure and no one can no longer get their hand caught in the machine and the machine can't run adequately because we've put too many things on it? You see, there's kind of a line there that when safe enough and like that. See, and yeah, it would be a ploy or a fraud if they didn't do what it is they promised, didn't do best efforts. If they do, it's kind of works both ways, though, because you get the benefit of it, right? You get the benefit of using the privileged guilt. And they get the benefit of having everybody know about it. Well, that's kind of good in all directions, huh? Yeah. So I don't see that that's a bad thing, really. A media ploy to capture favorable image and publicity. Yeah. As long as it's not just a media event. It's really done. It's really something that gets done. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So let's talk about the next one up, which is that they've actually done something wrong. Mm-hmm. Marcia and others are making a good point that whatever it is, it needs to be brought up into the light so that you can determine the extent. A lot of people who are in the United States, and I'm basically familiar with United States law, but not so much with other places, but I imagine this is an equivalent truth, because of course we're a global show. In the United States, if you find out about something that's really criminal, really seriously wrong, I don't usually deal with criminals in the sense of violence, right? I've never actually, to my knowledge, known anybody that's killed anybody, but I do occasionally find money wrongdoing, like embezzlement, some sort of fraud, some sort of expenses that aren't, that kind of a thing. Those do indeed carry criminal penalties. And if you find something out that is really seriously wrong like that, as Marcia says, to look to bring it to the light to determine the extent of the wrongdoing, you find something out that's big, well, you know, there is attorney-client privilege. You're not supposed to squeal on your clients if they tell you something. But there's also liability as an accessory after the fact if you help them cover it up. Quite frankly, if you tell me something under attorney-client privilege, I am forbidden by law, I could lose my license, to actually report you. However, if it's something, usually in my case it's business things, and now after you've told me, you want me to help to hide it because you have guilt, right? Right, actual guilt. The answer is no, because what you tell me from the past, I can't report. But I could be held liable as an accessory after the fact if I help you to cover it up. It's kind of like if you tell me you killed somebody, I can't report you, although quite frankly, I'd probably find a way to give somebody a hint that wouldn't lose me my license. So don't tell me these things. But if you say to me, I have killed my business partner, here's a shovel, help me get rid of his body. Now you've asked me to do something criminal, and I would be an accessory after the fact, and I cannot do that. Yes. And in most cases, there's a real good chance that I can now report it. Because that's not under attorney-client privilege. That's something that you'd like to hire me to do in the future. Yes. Yes, people are talking about privileged communication. You can tell me anything under privileged communication, attorney-client privilege, and I am forbidden by law to tell the law about it. And quite frankly, you probably will hear some things in your practice that you kind of prefer not to know. But since we have transparency, and since we are the leader and we want everybody to be able to talk to us, it's kind of good to know what's going on, because then you can assess the gravity of the situation. You can assess how bad off we are in this particular time with this particular set of circumstances. Exactly how bad off are we? Kind of bad off? Really, 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 really bad off? Yeah. So, you can determine what to do next for yourself, whether you're going to stay. And for your client, right? Yeah. Because they're feeling guilty anyway. Yeah, Vanessa and others are talking about the fact that oftentimes the wrongdoing is not really deliberate wrongdoing, but more like an act of omission. Didn't actively do something bad, but when it came to do some sort of action that we're supposed to do and we knew it, We didn't. We kind of just didn't. It just couldn't, and like that. Yeah. So it is a question of not so much deliberately acting, but deliberately omitting. I see that a lot in business. They omit whatever it is that is the fact that they're not legally obligated to divulge, which they know the contract signer, for example, doesn't realize. Because if they realized it, they wouldn't be signing the freaking contract. Yeah. And that's kind of guilt by omission. Mm-hmm. And then people feel bad about it later, and sometimes you can even get them to make it right. Mm-hmm. If you hit the right chord with them, the guilt chord. Yeah, because they probably don't have a legal reason to. And sometimes they just won't because they're not really that much in charge, right? And somebody else is watching them who doesn't have the guilt of wrongdoing. They say, take me to court. Okay. Yeah, some of the people, Edward and others are saying that generally speaking, the omission is deliberate, right? It's not an actual act of wrongdoing, but the omission is deliberate, and therefore it is an act of wrongdoing and worthy of guilt. Yes. Mm-hmm. Let's go on to the next one, because we want to get through all of these within our time period. You know, sometimes we have such fabulous discussions that sometimes we get a little bit delayed. Mm-hmm. I know, and I know you guys like at least one of the recipes. I'm going to try to do it. It's been hanging around for a little while. Pardon me. The next one we talked about that was popular from the responses, and thank you for all of your participation. You want to hear prior shows, you know they're archived on our website, www.recipeforpeacenow.com. Mm-hmm. And the next topic that we decided to talk about is when you know that you're biased, you know that it's wrong, you know it's not politically correct, but you like it. Yeah, you're gonna really think that way. Mm-hmm. You don't care. Yeah. Sheryl and others are saying that you don't care because you don't regard it as a bias. You regard it as the truth. Some people do. They've been taught something since childhood. And we as outsiders see it as the most outrageous bias and preconceived notion. But they don't see it that way. I mean, it was taught to them by their mom, by their culture, by their religion, by the way they lived, right? Breathing it in. And they regard what they think as the truth despite any kind of evidence. Yeah. They really do. They think of it as the truth, despite what anybody else thinks, despite the fact that nobody else thinks it is. Yeah. Uh-huh. They're the kind of people that start sentences with the words, everybody knows. And I always think, gosh, I must not be everybody because I didn't know that. Don't think it's true. Mm-hmm. So they're pretty set. What should we do about it? Thank you. Jason and a whole bunch of others, because you guys have been listening to this program, and thank you very much for being here, say that in order to find that out, let's break out the 5W questions that we're so fond of, right? Who, what, where, when, why? Who, what, where, when, why? The 5W questions. Let's think about them. Let's think about them to determine what we're dealing with. Let's think about them to determine how to stop it, mainly. Mm-hmm. Who, what, where, when, and why? Well, we won't ask them all at once, probably, but we'd like to know where that's coming from. Why you're so fond of it? Are we going to try to change your mind about your long-held bias and deep-seated belief in the truth of it? No, not our job. not unless we have to in order to get to our successful outcome, and that does seem unlikely. Yeah, we don't generally have to try to change people's long-held perceptions and beliefs. Let's just do it for now. So we're going to break out the 5W questions. We're going to find out what's the cause of this, right? Mm-hmm. Yeah, and as Anne and others are saying, the why is, why don't you care if we think that you're a bigoted part of the posterior there, right? Why? Why don't you care? Why do you hold on to that belief so tightly, even though it's been proven to be wrong, right? Why don't you care? And that's one of the things we're going to find out. Now, do you do this? And, you know, people ask this each time we talked about the 5W questions. And it's a real good question. Do you ask the 5W questions in front of everybody? Do you do them all at once, right? Do you do them in email? No, not an email for sure. The answer is, and I'm going to say what you guys say that I say lots, I'm going to say it depends. Yeah, because it depends on your group. Now, if you don't particularly want a lot of participation in the discussion as to why or any of the other 5W questions, then you should take it not to the whole group if you don't want a whole bunch of participation. Approach the person like at a timeout, right? Mm-hmm. Find out what's going on and then tell them how it doesn't apply here, right? Yeah. Maybe it's for the whole group. Maybe it needs peer pressure. You can decide that. I go easy on kind of shaming in front of the whole group. It's just my way, because then, pardon me, you've got some participants who feel kind of like they were singled out to be deemed less than perfect. How's that for being diplomatic? But they were kind of singled out, and nobody likes that. So, I'm not big on taking it to the whole group unless we're going to need peer pressure, right? Right. And also, don't forget that a lot of times, when you're dealing especially corporate, there are people who are in charge, more important than your participant, and you can go to them, right? And explain the situation and get a little help from above. Mm-hmm. Yes. God is always good for help from above, but I was thinking more on this side of the curtain. Mm-hmm. How, and other people, are saying that sometimes when people know they're wrong but they don't care, it's because they're bullies and they're being deliberately obnoxious. I think that's true. They're bullies and they're being deliberately obnoxious. Mm-hmm. What are we going to do about that? Oh, thank you. We have a substantial amount of people who come every week, and thank you very much for being here. And we're all saying the same two words right away when we hear the word bully and deliberately obnoxious. The civility rules, yes. Recipe for Peace now has very few rules. We don't like to write down a whole reams of stuff that then have to be interpreted. Mm-hmm. But we do have one big rule that goes to the civility rules, and then they're kind of filled in as the situation warrants. Right? Right. And the big rule is, we will not be rude to each other. We will treat each other with respect. Yes, we will not be rude to each other. We will treat each other with respect. Yes. Mm-hmm. The civility rules. The civility rules, it is the leader's duty to enforce. When you see the first attempt at bullying or obnoxious behavior, right then and there, don't wait. If you allow that to get to be in the dynamic of the group, if you don't stop them right away, right? If you permit anybody to get away with any kind of incivility, it's going to be real hard to get it back. the civility rules of respect and politeness and taking turns and not rolling one's eyes and watching the body language and no big sighing and stuff like that. The civility rules need to be enforced immediately, consistently, as in always, no matter how long the negotiations take, and fairly, so that you're not taking a side. Right? Right. Mm-hmm. The civility rules right away. Otherwise, you will get a group dynamic that you will have a hard time getting back. Mm-hmm. Yes. Yes, good point Muhammad and others are making, that as part of our transparency, as part of our ability to get the job done, and, you know, I'm kind of a pragmatist. I try to get the job done with as much grace and as much speed as possible, because people will kind of wander off. Life happens, right? Right. So Muhammad and others are saying that one of the ways to get going, a person who likes their biases, is to point out that the faster you reach a conclusion, the faster you can disband. Yes, this is a great surprise to many people. The faster we reach our successful conclusion, the faster we can get rid of each other. The faster we can disband, right? Yes. So whatever it is that's the bias, yes, let's make an exception for this group. Remember, we can't cure age-old biases that have been taught at your mother's knee and like that. Well, it's not our job to do that. It's our job to try to get this done, whatever the project is. So, you tell people you're going to make an exception. They are going to make an exception for this group and these issues at this time. We are going to set aside our biases just in this room with these groups, with this group, because we need to get to a successful conclusion. Yeah, we need to get it done. And quite frankly, as Muhammad says, the faster you reach a conclusion, the faster you can disband. And sometimes that is really a good incentive. We can get rid of this if we just reach a conclusion and implement. Right? Right. Let's all sit down and think about it and not just argue about something minor. Mm-hmm. Yes, an exception for this group, because they're an exceptional group. Yes, yes. Mm-hmm. Let's go on to the next topic, yes, which is over-exaggerated abilities and expertise. I see that a lot. And you see it mostly in people who are kind of new hires, because they've just kind of puffed themselves up to be on the job. And with the hopes that nobody will actually check too closely in a few months. And basically speaking, that's true. People don't, the employers and stuff don't keep updating their file on everybody. So if you just keep plugging along, maybe no one will know, but you'll know, and it gives you a guilty conscience. Yes. Yeah. Marley and others are saying that what you need to have is an atmosphere of trust so that everyone can admit what kind of help they need and get it, right? Especially if the omission, the exaggeration, the about your abilities and your expertise is not real deadly. It's not going to really hurt anything. Mm-hmm. It's just kind of more like puffery. Mm-hmm. Although I have seen references, actually never heard of the person. Isn't that funny? People don't think you're going to check references. Well, why not? What do you think I asked for them for? Yeah, so over-exaggerated. Yeah, you do need an atmosphere of transparency so that someone can come to you as leader kind of privately and ask if you're in trouble, if you've got the expertise, the knowledge, and like that. Mm-hmm. Yeah, as Bowden says, the leader needs to be available to give help and to ask questions. Yeah, that's a good point. Yasmin is saying that if you're going to have transparency, you need to ask for proof before the assignment, which would take care of it, right? You need to ask people for proof that they are, well, everything they say they are. Mm-hmm. The proof before you give them an assignment. That's a good point. It, not necessarily to lose their job, but to know if they can handle it. Mm-hmm. And yeah, this is a good point, too. Elizabeth and others are saying that it's not going to be a secret because teammates will know when they're in over their head. Yeah, teammates will know when you said okay, you said no problem, but we are having a problem, and your teammates will be kind of the first to know that. Mm-hmm. They know when you're in over your head, and they know you need to trust your teammates and to call in an expert. It's not a crime. It's just sometimes people want to be the leader. They want to be the leader of a subcommittee. They want it to come out really successfully. Mm-hmm. So you have to find it out, kind of fess up, and go get an expert. Go get somebody who really knows. There's no sense in guessing. No sense in guessing on the phone. No sense in guessing with your hands straight down, right? Yeah. There's no sense in guessing about people's expertise. You'll know. Mm-hmm. And then you call for help. Okay. The next one is ulterior secret motives and desires. Yeah. Well, the first one up is sex, right? Sexual harassment. Somebody wants to have private time with others, another participant, for example, or the leader. And they kind of prolong the process because they have a guilty secret they'd really kind of desire to be with them on a more intimate level. Yes. Mm-hmm. It's an age-old thing. And the question is the difference between, well, that would be lovely. Let's have a date. And sexual harassment is kind of a fine line. It's why there's a lot of rules on company books, which get violated because humans are humans. But there's a lot of rules about fraternization, about dating somebody within the company, mostly about not doing it. Yeah, yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, it does. It produces, Michael and I are talking about the fact that it produces an uncomfortable group dynamic. Mm-hmm. Uncomfortable troop dynamic. Mm-hmm. Might be a power grab. That's a good point. Suki and others are saying it might be a power grab. And you want to, because the person doing the grab wants to create chaos so it can step in. Wants to create chaos so it can step in. They have a power grab. Seen it. It's kind of ugly. Usually happens with partnerships. Isn't that funny? And also when board positions and positions for executive suite are revolving in the sense that they have terms. So you've always got a power grab going, right? Yeah. And it's a secret motive and it's kind of a guilty motive because it's not for the benefit of the company, which is really supposed to be your primary objective, to be an agent of the company or an agent of maybe the employees, for example, unions and things like that. And really secretly, you would like to grab the top spot and would, and pretty much I've seen people do a lot of, maybe not technically illegal, but pretty darn shady things under those circumstances. Yeah. To kind of create chaos, right? Because if there's a void, the first thing you have to know in a power grab is whose position you're grabbing and that they're going to be out, which means you're going to try to get them out, which means you're going to try to create some chaos, right? Yeah, because that's how you make the void. So, yeah, so that would be an ulterior motive that would be, if you were human at all, make you feel kind of guilty because you know these people, you've worked with them. Mm-hmm. What other kind of, this is a really good one too. You guys, you have wonderful devious minds, you guys. I've actually, you know, this is a little hard to ferret out, but I've actually seen this too. Sometimes you've got somebody with an ulterior or guilty motive, right, and a desire, because they are actually a spy from the competition. Yeah, they've been sent to report on what's going on your side. They've been sent as a spy. And then they feel kind of bad about it because they get to kind of be in with the group that they're spying on, right? Yeah, they're really spies. They're spies from the competitors. They're paid spies. I mean, they've come in as that. It's not accidental. You're in the group and somebody approaches you and blackmails you type thing. No, you came in as a spy. So Celeste and others are saying this is also a job for the 5W questions, to discover the true motives. 5W questions for the true motives. Yeah, you'd be surprised. Sometimes that does come out. I was going to say it's more so for bias and things like that, because people like to give their opinion, but they don't like to tell their secret kind of unpleasant reasons for being there. But we'll shake them down for it. Let's do the 5W questions. Who, what, where, when, and why? Especially if it looks like we are indeed having ulterior motives. And we're getting kind of a peculiar group dynamic. And we'd like to know why that is. It's so funny. Sometimes you've got, if you deal with enough corporate stuff, I've seen groups where everybody's got an ulterior secret desire motive. Yeah, you've got spies from different camps. I mean, it's just the darndest thing. And you can feel it in the atmosphere, the group dynamic of the room. You could feel the distrust, right? Yeah. Ooh. Yeah. You have to work that around with the 5W questions. And then if it comes down to this and you've got really, really competing interests, the group will have to dissolve and be reformed with people that of your choosing as leader. I have done that too. I have said, no, we're going to think about the dynamic of the group and we're going to choose other people who will be able to work towards the good of the group and not towards their own personal gain. Oh, Ahmed, yeah. Sometimes, all right. Sometimes Ahmed and others are talking about the fact that not only do you sometimes have an actual spy, as in somebody who's really came in that way, or somebody who's been turned in some way, and maybe because of extortion or blackmail, which would be another secret motive and desire, and a reason that you're doing something that seems kind of counterintuitive. Can I say that? Seems kind of like, really? Why? Yeah. And the answer is because I'm being blackmailed. Something has happened to me. Somebody's extorting money outright, like a percentage of my pay. Yeah. Yeah, people are saying that's an or else threat. Do this or else I will do something bad. And that gives you an ulterior motive because you don't want the bad thing to happen. And you've been threatened, so you're not certain that you should tell anybody about the bad thing. This is where the leader needs to be a person of trust, right? So that if something like that happens, sometimes it does. Depends on the stakes. Depends how much money really usually is involved, how much money and power. If something bad like that happens, you want to be the kind of leader where people can come up to you and tell you, can actually say that this bad thing has happened to me. I think you should know. And can you help me to work this out, right? Yeah. And, you know, it depends. It really depends on the threat. And like that. But you need to find out, and you need to understand that something bad is going on. If the person can't actually tell you. Right? Right. That's transparency. And that is a relationship of trust so that people feel comfortable that they can come to you with a problem. I know that you'll know how to handle it. And one of the ways that you get that kind of a group dynamic is to keep the group civil and convivial so that people feel comfortable. And in order to do that, you're going to need some timeouts, maybe even a timeout so that you can go and talk to somebody more away from the group, more one-on-one, right? Or a couple of people, not the whole group. Because sometimes people need a little, you might ask some of the 5W questions, for example, to learn something and to find out what to do about it. And that's why we're going to take frequent breaks, timeouts. And we're going to have some food. Yes, we are. Because everybody likes to eat, it gives you something that you're not going to argue about. How would you make that? It looks delicious. And it keeps everybody in the room. And lets people really get to know each other as human beings, right? Right. That's kind of the trick, to get to know each other as human beings so that we can deal with each other, so that we feel comfortable, so that we can interact. Now, if you're going to have food, and you are, we're going to have a survey that asks if anybody has an allergy, a restriction, or just doesn't eat some kind of food, and we're going to pass that around. Also, we're going to ask people when they bring something to bring a list with them of what's in it, not just what it's called, meatloaf, but what is actually in it, so I can run my eye down the list and find out if I can eat it or not. Right? Right. Now, I think we should have a safe recipe. Usually the leader brings that, or other people too. And a safe recipe is one that everybody can eat. We took the survey. And that my people would be familiar with. Right? Right. Now, the one we're going to do now is what I usually call the adventure recipe. It's an adventure recipe because it has seafood. And a lot of people either don't or cannot eat seafood. You've taken your survey. If you've got someone definitely like that, you don't bring this adventure recipe. Also, it has some ingredients that might be a little bit different and might not be so familiar to my people. And, of course, you know, my familiarity is not yours. This is a global show. I would consider a curry quite an adventure recipe, and you might think it's every day. Yeah, so you have to determine that. So this is a French seafood stew. Yes, I am. You know, people say I should take them more in order. If I don't get to one of them, which it looks like we're only going to do one today, that I should do the leftover one first and not just let it hang around forever. Honestly, I do them as much about considering how much time I think we're going to have. Okay, so this is the French seafood stew. I'm going to tell you, first of all, we're going to get some saffron. Very expensive, adds a lovely color and a lovely taste. Did I mention very expensive? You can do as you please with it. Take kind of a big pinch of saffron would be lovely in this. You know that you toast them through. You could put them in water also, but I like to toast them through because I think it gives them a better taste. I can control it better, and it smells lovely. Just for a minute. Dry skillet, high heat, stirring all the time for about a minute. Pull them out of the pot because they'll keep cooking, right? It's a hot pot. Stick them on a kind of spread out. Yum, yum, yum. Okay, so that's the saffron. If it's kind of a problem where you can't get it, it is also an adventure thing because not everybody has ever eaten saffron, right? Right, okay. Let's have a couple tablespoons of oil, a nice big sweet onion that we're going to finely chop. I quite favor Vidalia's. They are sweet as opposed to bitter. I don't like bitter in my food. Let's get us a fennel bulb that we're going to thinly slice, right? You could even reserve some of the little green leafy stuff on the top for an ornament. Looks real nice on the dish. You know, of course, that fennel is a tricky little creature, and it's got a lot of dirt in between the layers, so you have to wash it real thoroughly. I always take it all apart and wash it down because there's sand or something in there. Let's have 3 large garlic cloves that we're going to crush. You think I use too much garlic, use less. 4 cups of fish stock. You can't find fish stock, use vegetable. You can't find vegetable, use chicken, don't use beef. Too salty, too dark is what it really is. It's ugly in this. Two nice, large, ripe tomatoes, peeled and seeded and diced. We all know when I say that, that I'm going to use a can of diced tomatoes that I'm going to drain. You want to use a real tomato, yours will be even more delightful than mine, but it's already done for me. Just drain it out because we're not going to need the can liquid this time, although sometimes we do. Let's have a tablespoon of tomato paste just to thicken up the tomato stuff. A bay leaf, which we're going to try to remember to pull out. I like a little bit of sugar, like half teaspoon of sugar. I do. I think it brings everything out. It's just me. Let's have about 2 dozen large shrimp that have been peeled and deveined. Yeah, maybe even more. And, well, 2 dozen I'll do it. And get the large ones, not the squiggly ones that are kind of funny. And about 3 pounds of some sort of a white fish that's firm. We like monkfish around here. It's real easy to get is what it really the reason for it. About 3 pounds, maybe a little more. And give that a nice, cut them into big chunks, right? Yeah. We've done the saffron already. Remember, we toasted it, put it aside. You're going to get ourselves a nice big saucepan, not the little one we use for the saffron. We're going to heat the oil, add the onion and the fennel. About 3 minutes. Saute it until it smells nice, not squishy. Add the garlic, another 3 minutes. Mm-hmm. Everything's nice and soft, but it hasn't turned brown, right? Mm-hmm. Now we're going to add the stock and the tomatoes and the tomato paste and the bay leaf, hello, and the sugar. Bring it all to a boil because we've got a lot of liquid in there now. Reduce the heat. Simmer for about 15 minutes. If you've got facilities with the group where you can have a stove and simmer something, this smells fabulous. You should definitely do it in the room. Get it all kind of prepared and do it in the room, right? Yeah. Mm-hmm. Because it's simmering all away and it's uncovered and it smells delicious. What you're doing is reducing it. We're now going to add the shrimp and simmer until they turn pink, right? We're going to remember to pull out the bay leaf. I usually pull it off about now because otherwise I forget, in all truth and honesty. The shrimp are all nice and cooked. They've turned pink and everything. Let's put them, keep them a little warm, but put them aside because they're done and you don't want to overcook them because if you overcook them, they're going to turn to rubber. Mm-hmm. In fact, with this dish, because it's kind of got the delicate seafood in it, right, and it's all seafood, I put it out, however many people I've got, I put the shrimp out into the bottom of the dishes, the serving dishes already, so they don't go back into the broth to overcook. Right? Right. Yeah. I just divide them evenly. So they're sitting in little bowls that have been kept warm. Now we're going to add the fish and the saffron. Simmer for about 5 minutes until you've got your fish all flaking easily, right? Mm-hmm. All done. All delicious. Everything is hot and cooked through, right? Mm-hmm. Now's our time to put this over the shrimp, the broth and the fish and the whole bit with the tomatoes and everything else. Yum, yum, yum. Mm-hmm. Delicious. Everybody likes it. I usually serve rice on the side because, the little fennel tops that we saved, a little garnish just like parsley just because it looks pretty. Yeah. It's kind of a fancy schmancy dish in the sense that it's served because you put the shrimp out first so that they don't overcook, and then everything else on top of them in the bowls. Very nice. Good for not too many people, right, because it's a lot of dishes is what it really is. I guess there's always a lot of dishes because people take lots of dishes, even on a buffet. Everybody likes it. It is the adventure dish because of the seafood. Mm-hmm. And maybe because of other things, too, like the saffron, which is a little bit more unusual. Mm-hmm. Serve with rice on the side. Yeah, some sort of, you guys are going for pasta, huh? Yeah, you could do that, too. I usually just serve rice. Delicious, easy to handle. Not hard to do, really. And it is something you can do in the room because it smells so fabulous. Yes, and everybody will want to watch and have and see how you do it. My friends, we are out of time. Thank you for coming. Thank you for listening. Thank you for all of your participation. If you want to find us, we are at recipeforpeacenow@gmail.com. The website, www.recipeforpeacenow.com. Prior shows, they are archived on that website. Thank you. Thank you for your time. Thank you for your participation. And please do come again. Thanks. Bye-bye.